You're listening to 95.7 FM, KDRT LP, Davis, California.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
And that music means it's time for the Davis Garden Show. This is Don Shore.
And this is Lois Richter on a bright overcast Davis day. Danny, the weather is so weird.
It's pretty much what everyone's been saying for the last week. We had some rain the other day. It was a pretty good amount of rain, about an inch mostly around the area. Gentle, steady, very thorough. Kind of nice to have a rain in the first week of May, except for some of the side effects, which we'll talk about momentarily. We don't usually get a lot of rain here in the month of May. So this wasn't a deep irrigation. It didn't give the trees a whole lot of benefit, but it was great for those newly planted vegetables and the flowers and things that are out there. Lois and I are preparing this show for broadcast May 6th, preparing it for broadcast on May 7th, 2026. And the temperature right now is 61 degrees and overcast. The rain is pretty well done at this point. We might get a little bit more out of it. Today's high is going to be 79 degrees with a low tonight of 52 degrees. And boy, do we have a warm-up coming. This is very dramatic. People are getting very concerned because we're looking at 90 degree temperatures by the end of the weekend. So Thursday, they have the broadcast, 82 degrees. Thursday night, 52 degrees. That's pretty darn comfortable temperature range, I would say. Friday, 84 degrees and sunny. Friday night, 54 degrees and clear. Saturday, 91 degrees and sunny. That's the current forecast. It's dropped down a little bit from what I was looking at just yesterday for the Davis area. Saturday night, 56 degrees and clear. Sunday, 92 degrees and sunny. And Sunday night will be 58 degrees. And Monday, according to the National Weather Service, and this has bumped around for the last couple of days, they're now saying Monday will be sunny and hot with a high near 98 degrees. Which means we could hit 100. Monday night, mostly clear with a low around 61 degrees. And Tuesday, also sunny and hot with a high near 98 degrees. So we're already, of course, beginning to hear things like, oh, it will be too late for this, that, or the other, or various concerns about, of course, whether or not to water, what can go in, whether it's time to plant this, that, or the other, as I just said. Well, that's a very brief high temperature episode because by Wednesday, we're going to drop down to 84. Wednesday night will be 55. Thursday will be back down to 81. Thursday night will be 53. And Friday, the 15th, will be 79 degrees with a low of 52 degrees. So a three-day heat wave, if you will, high temperature event, more to the point, very low humidity, which will make a big difference with some of the disease problems that we're beginning to see. So we're going to warm up, we're going to get dry, and we're going to cool off again. That's the key part of the message here.
And this weekend is going to be beautiful for the Whole Earth Festival.
So that's Friday, Saturday, Sunday, correct?
That's right.
Whole Earth Festival is a big event that's been happening here in Davis since about the 14th century.
1970,
right? With the first Earth Day. Yeah.
The name changed. Some people count from 69 when there was an art thing. Yeah. I count from 71 when it's the first one with this name.
Okay, so Whole Earth Festival 1971. Yeah. Yeah, it's a big deal. Lots of people come to town. Lots of people like to take mom over there for Mother's Day because you can buy gigas and doodads from the artists who have been making a living at that for a good 50 plus years now. Whole Earth Festival Friday, Saturday, Sunday. Lots of other things going on around the area. We do want to mention that it's Big Day of Giving as this show is broadcasting. So we're going to talk about that briefly, but we'll talk about the other events first. We got a list of upcoming events that the Yolo County Master Gardeners are putting on from one of the active Master Gardeners. Thank you, Mike, for sending this along. And I want you to, Lois, just go ahead and mention maybe one or two of the upcoming events, and then I'll talk about how to get to them. Go ahead.
So the next one is May 14th, and that's the Monarch Butterfly Logistics. It's a presentation by Rich Maravich, and we'll be talking about propagating plants and building monarch way stations. This is a project that they're doing with Rotary, and it sounds like it's going to be fascinating.
Yeah, and they're focusing on how to grow and distribute milkweed host plants and nectar plants to master gardeners and others. That could be you out there using shared greenhouse spaces and then finding places where they can get out into the wild, if you will, or into people's gardens to draw monarch butterflies.
And then 2 weeks later, there, May 28th, is going to be a presentation by Mackenzie Patton about diseases and disorders in vegetable gardens. Oh, now, this sounds like a really useful one.
Yes.
And so, Don, how do they find more information about this and how do they find how to get there?
The UC Master Gardener Program of Yolo County is the title of the link you'd be going to. So if you just do a search for UC Master Gardener Program Yolo County, you will find them and you'll find the newsletter and you will find the upcoming events. And each one, you will find a Zoom link that you can log on to attend these meetings by Zoom. So the Monarch Butterfly Logistics one being the first one, they have the Zoom link there for you. These are all webinar programs. There's also in-person programs, and you can find out about those also at that same site. UC Master Gardener, Yolo County is exactly what I looked for. And that UC Master Gardener program, Yolo County, gets you there. They also have demonstration gardens, and I highly recommend that you make a note of these and figure out some way to get to some of them. Central Park Gardens in Davis, that's an easy one. The Don Finocchio Learning Garden in Clarksburg, that's a garden you can visit. The Grace Garden, which is here in Davis, at one of the local churches. Poudre Creek Council Nursery Demonstration Garden. These are all places you can go volunteer your time. So if you're interested in getting out, doing something in fresh air and meeting people who are into plants, UC Master Gardener Program, Yolo County is the information site.
Well, do you know Kat Anderson?
Oh, yes. Very well. Yeah.
She's got a new book out called Sing to the Earth and She Sings Back. And this is going to be a special event. It will be Thursday, May 21st, 9 to noon at Patricia Carpenter's garden. Mm-hmm. So
Kat Anderson is a prolific author, ethnoecologist, among other enterprises. I've known her for quite a long time. She worked for the U.S. Department of Agriculture, writing monographs for them about individual plants. But this new book is personal essays about restoring humanity's relationship with the natural world. I Sing to the Earth and She Sings Back, Kat Anderson. Hey, folks, our big spring fundraiser begins on May 7, the big day of giving here in the Sacramento region. That's a day when over 900 nonprofits all around the area come together at one site that's easy to navigate. If you've participated in the past, we thank you and urge you to join us again Thursday, May 7, with a donation to Davis Media Access, community media, including KDRT-FM for nearly 22 years now. New to it? Well, just head on over to bigdayofgiving.org and look for Davis Media Access and all your other favorite local nonprofits. Missed it? We'd love your donation during our spring fundraiser at kdrt.org. Just look for the support button. Thanks for supporting community radio. And as always, thanks for listening.
So for the first week of May, do you have instructions for this year, 2026, on how to water right now?
We've had rain, unlike last year. We've had two rainstorms at the start of this gardening season. So we had an inch of rain few days ago, and about a week prior to that, we had an inch of rain. So we're in better state than we were last year. Last year, 2025, our last rain, I think, was February and maybe a little bit in March, and people were planting their vegetable gardens in April into dry soil. We talked about that here because we were in that pattern earlier this season. I was very concerned we were going to have another year where people were going to put things in, turn on their Netafim system, watering it 5-10 minutes a day, and nothing would establish well. Well, we have better moisture this year, so we're off to a better start. My biggest concern, we're going to be 94, 95, even perhaps 98 degrees just a few days after this show broadcasts. Interior Southern California is going to be even hotter. This is a heat wave that's coming up from the south. So we're going to be hitting the 90s, and you may even be in triple digits down there after having been cool and moist. So my biggest concern right now is that sudden change to very low humidity, especially if it comes in on a dry wind, which it usually does here, a north wind causing the high pressure ridge to build, or as the high pressure ridge builds. That transition will shock young seedlings that you just put out there. You probably can't, quote, overwater, end quote, when something like that is happening. As we're heating up and getting very low humidity, watering each day is almost certain to be necessary for the next 1 to 2 weeks, depending on how quickly we cool off. So I guess that my main thing is, with a lot of people planting vegetables, this right now is our busiest vegetable planting and sales season at our nursery. Everybody's putting things in. They're putting them in. It's nice weather. They're hand watering them once, and then they're kind of walking away from it. Check daily, water as needed. It's one of the mottos of the Davis Gardens show. It's going to be especially important over the next 7 to 10 days as we suddenly go into temperatures we haven't had before and drop down to humidities we haven't had yet this season. The plants will acclimate to it. You don't have to water daily all season. In fact, we don't like you to water daily in general. These are young seedlings that are mostly still in nursery soil, gradually making root growth, sometimes rapidly making root growth, but still mostly in that light, fluffy nursery soil that you bought them in. So you're going to have to pay special attention to hand watering the individual plants at first. So next 7 to 10 days, be real careful to individually water those things. Make sure your dripper is right near the plant. Make sure it's getting a really thorough watering when it does. That's really the key right now, is the sudden change we're getting this season.
Okay, Don, we were just talking about the weather and how weird it is. Yeah. What has that done for, well, diseases?
Yeah, well, people are enjoying it. This is very comfortable weather for being out there pulling weeds. It's really easy right now. Chopping down grasses, things like that. So in terms of our comfort, it's great. Unfortunately, 55 to 85 degrees, which is an excellent temperature for plant growth, an excellent temperature for people to be out doing things, that's actually considered almost ideal comfort temperature range for human beings as well, is ideal temperature for a number of disease problems. And I just walked out this morning before even getting on the air here with Lois and sent a couple pictures of things that I have on my own property, because people have been bringing these in and talking to us about them at our nursery. I sent you two, and you can go ahead and read their names.
Anthracnose.
Yes. And? This was a fun one. You kind of mangled it earlier.
Entomosporium.
Very good. Entomosporium
means spore, huh?
Yeah. And somehow it relates to entomology. I don't know. I haven't looked up the origin of that particular plant pathogen name. These are two diseases that show up when we have rain late in the spring. Really, rain late April into May is fungus weather. It doesn't do that much benefit to the plants, except, you know, washing the dust off the leaves and giving maybe replacing one cycle of irrigation. What it really does is it makes leaf surfaces particularly amenable to infection by fungal spores that blow in as the storm is passing through. So the spores blow from leaf to leaf, and then it's wet on the leaf surface, so they are able to spend the few hours they need multiplying and then penetrating the leaf. So two in particular that people have been bringing in recently, and I'm sure we'll see a lot more of these over the next week. Generally speaking, when you get an infection, it takes about 3 days for plant pathologist types to see the symptoms, two or three more days for the leaf to be affected to the point that it might fall off. Right now, we have a carpet of leaves on our driveway from the London plane tree that I live under. I have a 60, 70 foot London plane tree. Many people call them sycamores, but this one is a London plane. Same genus, Platanus is the genus of the sycamores and London plane trees. They're getting anthracnose blight, which is a disease that attacks the leaf, spreads into the vein, frequently right on down to the petiole, the part that attaches the leaf to the stem, kills the petiole, which then causes the leaf to drop. And if you have a big tree and it's May and there's hundreds, if not thousands, of leaves up there, even if only a couple percent of them drop, it looks rather suddenly dramatic when your driveway is covered with leaves and they have spots all over them. That is anthracnose blight. It's a term for symptoms rather than the specific pathogen. So different diseases can cause anthracnose blight. The one you get on your ash tree is different than the one you get on your London plane tree, but they all have roughly the same temperature and moisture range in terms of infection. So we can say anthracnose is hitting the ashes and some of the maples and the London plane trees. It's not the same anthracnose, but it's the same problem. And so what you've got is a lot of leaf drop on trees that are otherwise looking very healthy. And if you look closely at the leaves, you see the spots on the leaves. The second one is...
But before you leave this one, Do all of the infected leaves drop off and that's it, you're done? Or are there still infected leaves up there
They're still up there.
continuing to go?
Yeah, it varies as to how much it affects a particular leaf. A lot of them will just have spots. Maybe it'll invade the vein, but not the petiole, so they'll have spots on them. Others, once it gets to the petiole, that leaf will drop. So you'll see them both on the tree and on the ground with the leaves on them. And they'll continue to infect as long as we have infectious weather. And we have definitely got infectious weather as we're chatting on the Zoom right now, because I'm looking out the window and it's gloomy and overcast and very high humidity and might even a little bit of showery rain today. So we'll have continued infection, which means that 3 to 5 days out, some leaves will start to drop from this cycle of infection. It will stop as soon as we get hot and dry. Shall we go back to the weather forecast? Hot and dry coming up this weekend. So that problem will solve itself. But then if we do get cool again, we get another rainy cycle, we can get a second, third, fourth cycle of this particular disease, as well as the other disease that we're seeing this year. Entomosporium leaf spot fungus.
There's got to be an easier way to say that,
There is
Tom. It's a
no common name that I know of. So you
black
can
spot,
just
isn't?
no black spots. Here's the problem with common names. They are
Purple spot.
there's no rules for them, so it doesn't matter. But you can just call it leaf spot fungus of pears if you want. Entomosporium leaf spot fungus. I always tell people that and write it down so they can go impress their friends and family. Oh, honey, our tree has entomosporium. It's
Wait a
another.
minute, is that worse than triplets?
It is a disease that again hits the leaf. It causes a black, very visible spot. I sent you a picture of that one.
Yeah.
Visible spots on the leaf, a number of points of infection. Same thing can happen. You can get an infection at the petiole, the base of the leaf, in which case those leaves will drop maybe 5, 10% of the leaves on this particular type of tree. The one that really gets it in our area, and also in Southern California, if you're listening in coastal areas, especially these were planted very heavily in the 1940s, 50s, 60s. Pyrus kawakami, so-called evergreen pear in Southern California, where they are evergreen through the winter. Here, sometimes they are, sometimes they aren't. So sometimes we just call them flowering pear. This is not the Bradford pear. This is not the Caleriana pear that we all love to hate. Now, there's a lot of good reasons for not planting Bradford pears and for disliking them. One of them is the disease problems they get. But this in particular, this disease, Entomosporium, hits a different species of pear, Pyrus kawakami. What we like about Pyrus kawakami is it blooms in December, January, February. It blooms before the almonds bloom. It's actually one of the very first flowering trees in our area. And in Davis, there are some of them in the downtown area, some of them on parts like F Street, 5th Street, where they were planted with Bradford pears. Back when Bradford pear was widely planted, unfortunately, sometimes for whatever reason, perhaps mislabeling, I don't know, you'd be going along, you'll see a whole bunch of Bradford pears and then like three Pyrus kawakami in the same row as if people planting them thought they were the same tree or something. They're doing a lot better because they're actually a much better choice. No, I don't really recommend them because of this particular disease problem, but they don't get fire blight as badly as the Bradford pear. They don't have limb splitting issues. They aren't reseeding all over the countryside. They don't have all the major negatives of the Bradford pear. They're a nice, relatively well-mannered, round-headed, sort of almost slightly weeping tree with shiny leaves, which unfortunately, when we get rain, April or May, get leaf spot disease and a lot of those leaves drop. About 6 or 7 years ago, we had a big problem with Entomosporium here. This is right about when Nextdoor was getting going as a social media site. It was my first experience of dealing with 100 armchair experts who didn't know what they were talking about. All of them came in when pictures of this got posted and said, "Hey, have fire blight. Look, that's fire blight. It's terrible. You'll have to take the tree out." No, I said repeatedly over and over again, it is not fire blight. That's different. That causes actual dieback. This just causes leaf drop. What do you do about it? Nothing. There's nothing to be done about it, and it doesn't matter. That's the simple, short answer. It's not really hurting the tree. Should I pick up the leaves? Sure, do that if you want to. Should I pick the leaves off the tree? Go ahead if you want to. If you have nothing else to do with your time, fine. But basically, the leaves that are infected will mostly fall. You can pick them up if you want. It'll stop when the rain stops. The plant is perfectly healthy and going to outgrow it. And in most cases, won't really have any long-term impact. Same is true of the anthracnose on your London plane for the most part. But there are a couple more comments about that.
So if this is, if the leaves fall off, then the stuff's on the ground. If they don't fall off, the stuff's up still up in the tree. Is this a disease which is just ubiquitous to the area, and whenever it's the right temperature, it shows up?
Yes. Yeah, okay, it's always here.
So you can't get rid of it.
No, no, nor would you even need to. It's not really hurting the tree all that much. It's simply unsightly, and it causes leaf drop at a time of year that confuses people. When we had this problem in 2019, I went back under my records and found, the last time we talked about this in a big way, 2019, very wet spring, tons of entomosporium affecting Pyrus kawakami around the area to the point there was a lot of leaf drop. And the problem with these discussions with people at my store is we get through the whole life cycle thing and explaining what is it, what do I do about it? Nothing. There's nothing to do about tree diseases, really, if you think about it. I mean, what do you, in the old days, I suppose they could get a cherry picker and a high volume spray rig and go up above the tree and shroud the entire neighborhood with fungicide. That isn't going to be happening nowadays. We don't do things that way. So basically you just wait it out. If you were to thin the tree out, when you do have it pruned, to get better airflow, that could be helpful. Prune it up a little bit so there's better airflow underneath it and so forth. Those are all perfectly reasonable things to do and good general principles of arboriculture for the trees anyway. So not a bad plan to do some of that. But it's not something that you're going to prevent. It's always here. It's on the tree and conditions just favor some years being worse than others. Just as with fire blight and certain other diseases, they just have their cycle. Fortunately, it's a fairly narrow temperature and moisture range and they just outgrow it. The case of the London Plane and the Western Sycamore. This is a case where when you're choosing your tree to put in, choosing one that's resistant to anthracnose is an option. In the case of London Plane, for example, the variety Columbia, which is the one we would predominantly sell if you were asking for a London Plane tree now, has resistance to both anthracnose blight and powdery mildew. The variety Blood Good has resistance to anthracnose blight, but not powdery mildew. The variety Yarwood has resistance to powdery mildew, but not anthracnose. So choosing between the three, if you can find Columbia, get it. If you're in the Bay Area, choose Yarwood because your problem is mostly powdery mildew. If you're in the valley and you don't have Columbia available, choose Blood Good because our problem is mostly anthracnose. Again, it doesn't really hurt the tree, but it bothers people when that many leaves are falling off in the spring. So you'd look for the more resistant variety. I've seen anthracnose get bad enough on unnamed varieties, not non-varietal London Plane tree like Central Park in Davis. Part of it can get very bad to the point that there's a lot of leaf drop and the trees are stunted by it. But part of that is just how closely together they've been planted. The spacing of the London Plains in Central Park is closer than would be optimal for the trees. I'm not going to propose they take out half of the London Plains in Central Park because that would cause a firestorm of negative publicity. But it wouldn't be bad for the trees if we were to do that. So just choosing one that's more resistant if you happen to be planting London Plane. I will say, London Plane tree is our most common shade tree in Davis. When they recently did a survey of the street trees in Davis, it was number one in terms of both the number of trees and the amount of shade that it's providing, which is great. That just means we've got enough of them. So if you're choosing a tree, I would suggest you not plant London Plane. I would suggest you plant something else anyway. But if you are choosing London Plane because you need a big, fast-growing tree that will provide shade quickly and doesn't have a lot of drawbacks, look for Columbia or Blood Good varieties. With respect to entomosporium leaf spot, there are no resistant varieties and it really doesn't matter. So don't worry too much about it. But I want people to be aware of this. And also be aware when you see this kind of disease, other diseases are also infecting. So for example, someone brought in what looked like a septorial leaf spot on her tomato plant, which had apparently been on the plant when she purchased it, thankfully not from me, and because of the rain and the cold temperatures was splashing and spreading on the plant. Well, you've got a bit of a problem that when I spoke to her a week ago, because we had more rain coming. So in that case, yes, picking off the small number of leaves on a small plant and putting them in a bag and throwing them away would probably help prevent further infection. In the case of a tree or something like that, of course, that's just simply not practical. But I want you to be aware that we're going to see probably 5, 7, 10 days of different diseases showing up because of this last week of cooler, but also wet weather causing infectious periods. Symptoms will show. Major symptoms will be visible in about a week. So there'll be some other problems out there, which we'll perhaps talk about next week.
Okay. So I have a message, and this is from Kathy. It says, I have a new vertical planter. It's called the green stock for my courtyard. And I want to plant some things for late spring and summer. I know that I will have to be careful with watering and can revolve it to give each plant sun over the week. What starter plants do you have in stock at this time, which would work? I have two levels of pods, one for shallower roots, 6 inches, and one for deeper roots, 9 inches.
Okay, so I've looked at some of these. I get these questions all the time, and I've looked at this one online. This is a series of long, narrow tubes. They're about the size of a 1 gallon can cut in half. And they're attached to a pole so that you're going vertical. It's a great idea if you have a courtyard or an apartment, and you just have a terrace or something like that to grow things on. And the one picture that I'm looking at here on, who is this? Amazon, there it is all full of small brassicas, bok choy, lettuce, spinach. These look like they're all shoved in here just to take the picture. But these are all things that would actually grow in these and would do well in them in the fall, winter, and early spring. The summer is going to be a big challenge for this thing. And we go into this with any of these sort of, I'm not going to call them gimmicks, but these devices, these planters, these trends. This vertical gardening has been around for a long time. It's very similar to the idea of growing a green wall. In an area where your humidity gets below 10%, sometimes in the summer, and is routinely below 20-25%, where your temperatures are above 90 degrees. I mean, our July high temperature average here is 93 degrees, 91 or 92 in August, and low humidity every afternoon. These are going to be a huge challenge to keep watered. And everyone who's tried them usually does them for a year or two and then just kind of gives up on them. Don't give up. Try different things. Okay. So
I'm looking at the ad because I looked it up, and this company says set of three. So it's 1, 2, 3, 4. It's 5 tiers and it supports plants of any size. And then it says perfect for growing tomatoes, peppers, cucumbers, pole beans, and eggplants. But tomatoes have 4 foot long roots.
None of those. None of the things they just listed are likely to do well, except beans are certainly worth a try. Although I would do bush beans, not pole beans. You've got to just get small plants, and you're going to need to water this every day. And there's a high likelihood during a heat wave, or especially when we have a north wind event, you'll have to water it a second time during the day. Not for very long. It's not going to take a lot of water, obviously, to fill the thing the size of, half of a 1 gallon container with water. So you're going to want something that goes on the top. Some of these have a reservoir that makes it possible for them to water more or less automatically, but they're going to need water consistently. And one day without water, the whole thing will dry up and die, which will be very demoralizing. First of all, I would set this, in spite of the fact that it's for plants that want full sun, I would put it in light afternoon shade if you possibly can. Because full 5 o'clock sun on this thing is just going to cook the plants. So I would figure out some way to shade it from the west. Try different things. The likeliest to do well would be some common culinary herbs, kitchen herbs like thyme. English thyme is a little plant, stays very compact. So is French thyme. Tarragon would probably work in there. You could do parsley for a while. It would eventually outgrow it because it's taprooted, but it's certainly worth a try. So I would think kitchen herbs that are not the woody things like rosemary, but the smaller shrubby or herbaceous herbs would be a good possibility. If your local garden center happens to have some of these new dwarf tomatoes, try one. That's these miniature tomatoes from the Dwarf Tomato Project. They're worth a try. There's a type of basil called Spicy Globe, which was one of my favorites until the new Emerald Tower series came along. Spicy Globe, very tight, compact grower, strong flavored. Doesn't matter if it's flowering. It doesn't become astringent when it's blooming, so people can use it even in bloom. That's worth considering. No squash, no eggplants. Of all the peppers, there's a couple that I would consider. And again, they're probably going to need more water than is going to be optimal. But small, fruited, abundant types like shishitos would probably do well. Banana pepper. Trying to think of the other heavy producer. Well, gypsy. Gypsy is actually a sweet pepper that might do well for you. And things like jalapeno or Fresno, the smaller hot peppers would probably do okay as long as they get enough water. Here in the Valley, my guess is by mid-August, there'll be some mistake. It won't get properly watered. Everything will dry up on one side or who knows. Don't give up. Try different things, but eventually you're likely to shift over gradually to more succulents and things like that, to more ornamental plants. But consider the cooking herbs. That's the only group I can really think of that would be likely to tolerate the sun with that limited root system. And then, as I say, try very miniature versions of some of the vegetables that might be out there.
What about strawberries? I remember that we used to have strawberry pots that were big barrels with little divots carved into the side. And if those would work, maybe
they probably would. I mean, people bring me pictures of this idea that was going around for a while of growing strawberries in rain gutters, not on
your house, goodness.
But taking a rain gutter, the 6-inch deep ones, for example, filling it with soil, and attaching it to a fence and running a drip line across the top. And this is where the emitterized Netafim tubing with emitters every 6 inches would be great. You run it every single day, at least once a day, possibly a second time in a very hot spell. Here's the key. If you plant Quinault variety, that one will fruit on the runners, unlike a lot of the others. So one of the reasons it became very popular, Quinault is a very popular variety with really good flavor, is it doesn't produce just the main plant itself, which all of them will do right after you plant them. One of the reasons I like to sell strawberries to beginning gardeners, even though there's issues with them, they fruit almost no matter what. Quinault sends out runners, as strawberries do, and pops out fruit right on the runners, which is really cool. So that's the one I would do. Again, there's going to be a time limitation on this. After a few months, they'll be root bound. Something will go wrong with the watering. Okay, you had fun. You got a bunch of strawberries. Pull them out, freshen the soil, put in something else or some more strawberries. So there's certainly things you could do. Light shade would make it easier in terms of managing it, but that's not going to be optimal for food production. If it comes to that, it goes into more shade simply because you have trouble keeping it watered. Alpine strawberries would do well. Now, they can tolerate shade. They do need a lot of water, but they would probably grow and produce well in that setting. So these, in fact, strawberries were some of the first things these were heavily promoted for, these kinds of planters. And they will, in fact, work. If you buy a 6-pack of strawberries, they're usually flowering when you buy them. They frequently have fruit on them when you buy them. Put them right in. They'll continue to fruit for at least several weeks as long as you keep them properly watered. Getting them through a couple of years in that planter, no, that's not likely to happen, but at least through a good part of the summer would be great. So try different things, shade it lightly from the west, figure out how you're going to water it, and try to choose a potting soil that'll retain moisture to some degree. If you're not listening locally, your local garden center probably has one that is a little more moisture retaining. It's going to be a more organic content, or there might even be some of the ones out there in some areas that have the polymers added to retain water. Those are good, would be good possibilities in this situation, because keeping it watered is just going to be your biggest issue in the arid western states.
So that answers Kathy's question. And I know that, Don, you have to be very careful about what you say about things. I don't. I don't sell anything.
Yeah.
But for those listeners who do not have one of these things, don't buy it, man.
They're great.
You can do so much better if you give those roots more depth. 6 inches is, 6 inches. Come on.
Really, the key to learning how to garden in the Sacramento Valley and places like the Sacramento Valley is learning how to water. And there's some situations where the watering is going to be hugely challenging. And that's just going to be the case on this one. So that's the biggest issue. Put in some kind of a system. You're not going to hand water this. And if it requires.
And you're not going to go on vacation if you.
No, right. You can't go on vacation at all. If you do go on vacation, set it up on a timer, by the way. And you can get great mechanical timers that go right on the hose faucet that might be controlling the irrigation to this. I'd have it come on every day. And you may need to have someone check on it if there's a heat wave. That's the main issue with them. These are obviously designed by people in milder climates with respect to summer temperatures and humidity. And we see this all the time. The green wall, the living wall, the moss wall, things like that, they just don't work here. Sacramento Convention Center, they built that massive building down near K Street, and they decided to do living walls on the west side of it.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. On the outside west side?
Yeah, and I happen to be driving through there every couple of months to go do the radio program in Sacramento. And so I watched the progression of this thing. Gradually, everything they got planted was replaced with rosemary, which worked really well, but everything else failed. So look, when you find the one thing that works, rosemary is a good choice. It's a nice plant. It blooms in the winter. So cool.
Yeah. And that's one of the reasons that Don doesn't sell those hanging baskets that you see all over the place, just because you can't keep them watered.
I had someone walk in here during a heat wave a couple of years ago, came sauntering in. He was new to the area and he's looking around with a sort of confused expression, like, where are your hanging baskets? We always buy a couple this time of year. And I said, well, welcome to Davis. Welcome to California.
You could tell.
You have to water them at least once a day, twice a day, very commonly here, or they will die abruptly. And that's very disappointing. So if you're going to do hanging baskets here, generally focus on succulents. What I would probably end up filling this thing with if I had it is one of these cool Delasperma ice plants, which have the showy flowers like the variety John Prophet. And I'd fill with a couple of different kind of ice plants with different colors, let them cascade down till it looked like Cousin It.
Make an abstract out of it.
There you go. An abstract art project will probably be more productive than food stuff. But there are food things that'll probably work. So try different things. And going back to kitchen herbs, for example, chives would almost surely grow in there. And even if they go really dry, they'll come back if you water them. So experiment, see what works for you. And the winter will be great. Starting in about September, October, you could fill that thing with lettuce, kale, things like that. You could do any of the leafy greens. Spinach would do fine, and it'll actually sort of water itself through the winter. I will say with that limited root volume, you will probably have to supplement the water periodically during the fall, winter, and early spring, just because of long intervals between rainfall, but the plants will survive without daily watering as we get into the rainy season. So you'll have fun, more fun with it in the winter and less failures. Give it a try. Be experimental. Don't blame yourself if something goes wrong.
So Don surprises me with things sometimes. And this time he sent me a picture and I came up with hippopotamus stream as the name. That's not right, but oh, it starts with a hip.
Hippiastrum. I sent you a picture of a hippiastrum, which is not the name. Well,
that's
most
a, people. That's a lily, Don.
It's not a lily. It's an amaryllis. It is the plant most commonly called amaryllis, just to confuse things. This is a case where common names and botanical names are just going to throw us all over the place. Lois and I love to talk about the actual amaryllis, which is Amaryllis belladonna, which is
naked lady.
Naked lady. Pink flowers, July and August, wonderful plant. At Christmas time, people may give you these giant bulbs, sometimes in bloom, sometimes just getting ready to bloom, sometimes still in bulb form. They're even selling them coated with wax and glitter and doing horrible things to these bulbs, but they will bloom almost no matter what when you get them for the holidays. And that's the hippiastrum, Dutch amaryllis, giant amaryllis. Amaryllis is a common name for the plant whose genus is hippiastrum. The picture that I sent was six leftover bulbs that I shoved into a pot 3 years ago. In the same pot, I used citrus and palm mix because it's more mineral soil, because I knew they were going to stay in this pot for a long time. And how many flowers are in that picture?
Six or seven. I can't tell.
And they're almost as big as your face, every one of them.
It's huge.
So here's the common question.
Reddish, orangish red with a white center and green tendrils coming out. This is gorgeous.
And I do nothing to these. I just shoved them in a pot in a good quality potting soil, and I set them where they get watered more or less automatically. And if they go dry, it isn't that big a deal. They're pretty tolerant of it. Typically, they'll root through the pot into the ground below if they're able to do so, but they don't really even have to do that. And this is when they actually bloom naturally. So those amaryllis bulbs, hippiastrum bulbs that you get around the holidays, have either been forced into dormancy by withholding water if they're from the northern hemisphere, or simply, this is more recent, over the last decade, grown in the southern hemisphere in Peru, which is where these bulbs came from, and then they let them go into their normal dormancy and they ship them to the northern hemisphere in October, November, where they think it's summer, and so they come into bloom. It's just their natural cycle. They don't always come into bloom when you want them to. We get them in, we'll get in, you know, 50 or 100 of each variety, and most of them will bloom for the holiday, but some of them just sit there and bloom for Easter or bloom for, you know, May, whenever they feel like it.
So when you're done with it, and if you take it out and put it in the ground, is it going to continue on its odd cycle, or is it going to switch over?
No, it'll come to this cycle, and it may miss the first year, but these are bulbs that are blooming now on their natural cycle, which is May to June. But so you get the question of what to do with that amaryllis bulb someone gave you. Well, if you're in USDA zones 9 or 10, sunset zones 8, 9, 14 to 24, you can just stick them in the garden if you want to. Full sun is fine. Light shade is okay. You can cram them in a pot with other things. You can put a bunch of them together in a pot and they'll bloom on their own year after year after year. And they can stay root bound in the same pot for many, many years. Now, if you're listening, obviously, where it snows or freezes, these are too tender for that. In fact, the Western Garden Book tells me sunset zones 16, 17, 19 and 21 to 24. So that's all Bay Area and Southern California. But I can absolutely verify that they will grow successfully outdoors in sunset zones 8, 9, and 14 as well.
All right, Don, I've got an article here about the other summer vegetables. We've talked about a few of these, but let's talk about beans this time. Beans are a fun topic.
Yes, and they don't like heat, but in terms
they don't
of,
like heat?
They don't like heat. That is correct. So beans, if you're growing green beans, like cooler conditions. They're, in fact, one of the first summer vegetables we can plant. We often put them in, if we have something approaching normal weather, in March or early April. If they're growing into June, July, August, and we're getting our normal high temperatures here, a fair number of the flowers. Sometimes all of the flowers will simply blank. They'll flower, they will set what appear to be beans, and then you'll realize there's no beans in the beans. So that's a little disappointing. So my pattern with green beans now is I plant them at the beginning of the season. I use bush beans instead of pole beans because I just find that easier for my own gardening organization. And then when that particular plant is done, I cut it off and I compost the top. And a few weeks later, I'll probably plant some more. I'll usually plant some in late August, early September to try to get a fall crop on them. In our climate, the most popular bean in the United States does not grow well, Kentucky Wonder. Kentucky Wonder is heat sensitive. Anything above about 85 degrees, Kentucky Wonder beans are going to blank, has been my experience. And so from the very first time we opened, taking the advice of old timers and our own experience with them, we sell Blue Lake, which is a very adaptable green bean that sets even into somewhat higher temperatures, although it does not set well mid-June through mid to late August. So it's a great one for an early crop, a great one for a late crop, and one of the best for this area. Blue Lake comes in both pole and bush forms. My experience is the pole forms go all over the place and I find them impractical. When I did grow them, I got lots and lots of beans. So if your goal is high production for freezing, things like that, early planting of pole beans of Blue Lake would be a good option. If you just want beans to sample and maybe have a side dish for dinner every now and then, bush beans are great because you can put them in right next to your tomato plant that you just planted and they'll grow and do their thing and be done by the time the tomato is ready to crowd them out of that part of the garden. So I use bush beans as sort of filler, soil builder, small crop kind of thing. This climate, they're not that happy about the high temperatures we get in the summer. If you like to grow beans for drying, that is really easy and has been done commercially in this region for decades. So you can grow pinto beans and all the other beans that we then dry in the late summer. Really easy to grow here because we're really dry in the late summer, guaranteed. You can take them off the plant, spread them out on something right out in the sun. They'll dry down to the point that you can store them right out there, clean them up, take them in and use them in cooking all through the winter. So if you like to grow dried beans, that's very easy to do. And there's dozens, if not hundreds, of fascinating varieties of them out there. This is a great place here in the Sacramento Valley to do that. They can be planted anytime. They're not as sensitive about high temperature with respect to yield.
Hey, Don, when I was a student, we planted along the side of our house to shade our house, mm-hmm. Scarlet Runner beans. They had mm-hmm. these giant long beans. Are they still around?
Yeah, well, yeah. Scarlet Runner beans are something I grow almost every year. They're very pretty. Hummingbirds actually love the flowers. I don't know if you noticed that.
Beautiful
at the time.
Red yeah, flower.
Red yeah. flowers are very showy. The bean is edible. It's mild flavored. They follow the same pattern as the others. They'll tend to set early and then bloom a lot in the summer and then tend to set some late in the season. And I've had people take the beans themselves and dry them just like regular dried cooking beans. They're fine for that as well. So if you're looking for a quick summer screen, you want to shade a window that you can't otherwise get some shade on, a really simple wire or even netting type trellis and plant the beans now, basically month of April, May into early June or as late as the 1st of July, they'll grow very rapidly and give you some nice shade and flowers right through the summer. And yes, the beans of Scarlet Runner beans are edible.
And then what about those yard-long beans or asparagus beans?
Yeah, they're a different plant entirely, actually. They're not a bean. They're not a bean, but they really need heat. They're quite the opposite of what we just talked about. We don't even plant them until mid to late May. And once they get going, they're a tropical plant. Once they get going, they just race and they produce all summer long. They're very, very easy to grow. The texture is a little slipperier than your common green beans. This is an issue with beans, by the way. I like Roma, the Italian style beans, but they have a slippery texture on the skin. My kids would never eat them when they were young. So I was the only one in the household that would eat the Roma beans or any of that kind of Romano type beans. Yard long beans have a similar slippery texture. They're used in stir fry. They're delicious and very easy to grow. They're a good way for us to get beans, if you want to call them that, in the summer because they're more heat tolerant than the regular green beans. So plant green beans first, yard long beans, then another planting of green beans. You'll be set all the way up practically till Thanksgiving. Many years ago, one of the old timers in Davis, she was a Mrs. Montgomery. Montgomery Avenue is in South Davis. So she was an old farm family. And she was in her 70s in the 1980s, and she'd come in looking for Kentucky Wonder bean seeds in the middle of the summer. And so needless to say, when someone is buying something odd at an odd time of year, I have a conversation and I said, that's interesting. You're planting these now? Yep. I always plant Kentucky Wonder beans in August, she said, so that I'll have a good crop for Thanksgiving. Put that out there. Anecdotally, old time gardener knew what she was talking about, planted Kentucky Wonder, which I don't recommend here because it's not heat tolerant, in the midsummer because it'll be setting in the early fall. for her Thanksgiving dinner table.
Well, speaking of Thanksgiving, what about pumpkins? We need pumpkin pie.
Very, very easy to grow as long as you have space. I grow pumpkins every year because that's one of the great luxuries of living out in the country is that you can plant vines that will run literally 30 feet from where you plant them and produce all kinds of pumpkins. If you are growing them for pie, it seems to me still the very best pie pumpkin is a variety called Sugar or Pie. It's been around for 300 plus years, so that's definitely an heirloom variety. I grow it every year. I'll plant three or four of them in one hill, as we call it. That's just the way they're traditionally grown. Give them lots of water. Pumpkins are deep-rooted and vigorous vines that need deep watering, like a watermelon. Their roots go down 3, 4, 5 feet. You want to water them like your tomato plants, several gallons of water all at once, and give them room to run because they will go as far as you let them. It doesn't matter, by the way, if they run up onto things. I had one year where a jack-o'-lantern pumpkin went right up and over a mandarin tree. It was fine. It looked great. Fortunately, the pumpkins were down at the ground level, but you can stake them up. You can put them in a tomato cage. I've done this with the small ones with great results. So one year I tried it with the bigger ones with some 10 or 12 pound pumpkin variety, whatever it was. I have a picture.
Broke your wires, didn't it?
No, it didn't. Actually, this is great. I have a picture of the 6-foot tomato cage, regular tomato cage with out of concrete wire with a pumpkin that went up to the top, out the top, back down to the ground, set three full-size pumpkins in the cage. That was the part I was concerned about. And then ran off into the bushes nearby from the cage. But those were fine, and it held, to my amazement. One of the things they've selected pumpkins for over the years is strong stems, because it is a jack-o'-lantern plant. People need to be able to carry them. So sturdy stems are, believe it or not, actually a breeding goal. And this one was fine, and I just opened up the cage at the end of the season, snipped them off. There were my three pumpkins from a tomato cage. So you can do that. You can let them climb on things and run all over the place. But a single pumpkin vine is capable of running 15 to 30 feet with no problem in a single season. You can guide it. It's running towards a path, just lift up the vine, set it where you want it to go. What you don't want to do is ever cut that growing point, because it's really important for pumpkins and melons, but especially pumpkins, where you have a vine that's feeding this growing fruit back at the end, at the beginning part of the vine. It needs new leaves coming on, needs new growth coming on steadily throughout the season. Older leaves will start to yellow and shed. That's normal. That's part of the normal cycle of the plant. But if that's happening and new growth isn't occurring, the development of the fruit will stop and they won't get as big as they're supposed to get. So you want them to be able to grow freely wherever they wish to grow with some guidance from you. They're kind of like children, you give them a little nudge, but you got to plan for their ultimate size. Very easy to grow. And as I say, Sugar or Pie are the best ones for pie. And it's worth growing at least once. Someone said to me, can I grow pumpkins as good as what I can, as the pumpkin pies that I get? I said, you can grow pumpkins that are better, because those are not pumpkins. Those are a hybrid squash if you bought them in a can. You can grow real pumpkins and make real pumpkin pie and be the real snob at your Thanksgiving table, because you actually grew your own pumpkin for pumpkin pie. Easiest thing to do. Personally, I grow pumpkins for pepitas.
What's that?
The seeds. So I grow particular varieties that are grown with, I have to say this carefully, hullless seeds. Seeds that do not have a hull on them. So they're tender. And when you roast them, they're quite delicious. If you like to grow pumpkins and you have room for them, I highly recommend you find some of the varieties, like one called Kakai, K-A-K-A-I, or Godiva, like Lady Godiva. They're naked seeds. There's a couple others out there that are naked seeded, and they're definitely worth it because they're just delicious. They got great flavor and they're very tender and they're fun to grow, and they're relatively small fruit, so you get a lot of them on a single vine. It seems that a pumpkin vine can produce a certain number of pounds. So if it's a 40 pound pumpkin, you're going to get one. If it's a 5 pound pumpkin, you're going to get eight. So the volume of the fruit yield appears to be fairly consistent, and it just depends on how big a variety you happen to choose. I have grown giant pumpkins. It's kind of fun, but I'll tell you something, having an 80 or 90 pound pumpkin,
What are you going to do with it?
Well, yeah, I take them to the nursery and set them out as decorations for the season, but that's pretty much it. So I would suggest, if you're really going to put the space into this, either grow one of the ones that's bred as a jack-o'-lantern type pumpkin, or grow one of the ones for pepitas or for pie.
So is a pumpkin a squash?
They're all in the same family. Cucurbitaceae. They're all cucurbits is what we call them. There are different divisions within cucurbitaceae, pumpkins, cucumbers, melons, squash, and so forth. Pumpkins and squash are closely related. Within the cucurbitaceae, there are groupings which can interhybridize. and groupings which do not interhybridize. And pumpkins and squash can hybridize, and you can get actually a pumpkin-like squash that's very desirable. That's what you buy in a can when you buy pumpkin pie filling. Or you can end up with something in your garden that you don't really even know what it is if you grow the seeds out the next year, because you do get that interhybridization within these categories of cucurbitaceae.
So we can grow squashes here in the summer. And of course, there's zucchini. Everybody knows zucchini. And then a patty pan and some of the other gourmet varieties. Mm-hmm. But there are also squashes that are called summer squash. Mm-hmm. And squashes that are called winter squash, and they all grow here in the summer. Don, it's very confusing.
Oh, they all, this is a great place to grow anything in cucurbitaceae. These are plants that like a long season, lots of sunlight. They like low humidity. The only thing they really need is plenty of moisture, and most of them are very deep rooted. A lot of members of cucurbitaceae come from regions that are very dry at much of the season. Southern California, we have a plant, manroot. It's actually in other parts of California, but I remember the manroot. We only got in San Diego, 9 inches of rain a year or something like that? Almost all of it between November and February. With the first rain, up comes manroot, which is in cucurbitaceae. It's a wild cucumber, basically, from a giant storage tuber that's below ground. As soon as it rains, it triggers that to grow. In the matter of 2 to 3 months, it'll grow 20 to 30 feet and completely cover a nearby shrub or tree. In the middle of that process, just a few weeks in, it's blooming. It sets these little spiny cucumber things that are insanely bitter. They are ready to dry and fall to the ground as seeds within about 10 weeks of having sprouted. And then it stops raining. The plant goes completely dormant again. So it puts on a ton of growth during a very short rainfall season. So many cucurbitaceae are adapted to periods of drought. And part of that adaptation, in the case of that one, is a big storage organ. But in the case of the others, it's just very deep roots that'll find some moisture that's further down there. So a lot of them come from areas where there's intermittent rainfall, but hopefully a lot of it all at once, perhaps, to keep that deep root system going.
So, but tell me about why winter squash is called winter squash when you grow it in the summer.
Yeah, it shouldn't be called winter squash, because every year someone comes in the fall looking for winter squash to plant because they think it grows in the winter. Winter squash, like pumpkins, has a tougher skin that allows it to sit out in the garden even when it starts to rain, maybe even snow a little bit as we get into the fall, and that protects it from spoilage. Your zucchini isn't going to be protected from spoilage.
So like butternut and Hubbard and acorn squash and all those things that have a when you knock on them, it's a hard surface.
It takes a heavy duty.
Don't knock on your zucchini.
It takes a heavy knife to cut through them. If you ever cut a pumpkin in half to roast it. So they are plants that store, or the fruit, I should say, that store through the winter. If you had a root cellar, that's where you'd put them, but you don't absolutely need that. The whole point of a root cellar is you have shelves and things down there that keep the plant from staying too wet on the bottom. For example, they'll have air movement underneath them. The temperature is very even. Humidity is very even, and so they'll store for months, and you can store winter squash through the winter, hence the name. But unfortunately, it leads a lot of people to think that we grow them in the winter time. No, it's just other members of cucurbitaceae that are grown primarily for winter storage. Now, zucca, I understand from an Italian customer, is just Italian for squash. So zucchini is just Italian for a little squash, or a particular type of squash. They don't call them zucchini in Italy. We call them zucchini in this country, is my understanding. Once again, correct me if I'm wrong. If you're out there, you're an Italian speaker with a knowledge of the culinary traditions of Italy, let me know. But my understanding is that zucchini is just something we call a particular type of summer squash, closely related to crookneck, closely related to patty pan. Those are all very similar. One difference I have found is that zucchini is a little more temperature sensitive. So the joke about the too much zucchini thing is not as much of an issue in the valley as it is on the coast. My father would plant 6 zucchini plants every spring, 6 zucchini plants, which would in coastal San Diego would give us hundreds of zucchini. I don't know, some giant amount that I would have to put in a wheelbarrow and take door to door and try and sell to my neighbors. This is why he planted 6 every year.
Something to keep Don busy.
That's right. Start your retail career early. In the valley, they set early and you get several zucchini And then they keep flowering, but as it gets above about 90 degrees, I find that they just don't set well. So from mid-July till about the end of August, you're not getting much zucchini. And then there's a nice big spurt of flowering, much as with some of our tomatoes, nice big surge of flowering mid to late August that then gives us lots of fruit late. So we're dumping zucchini on people's porches in September, October here, not typically early in the season. All the other summer squash produce more consistently. So, if you happen to really like summer squash and you really want them steadily in your garden, I'd plant almost anything but zucchini. I would plant patty pan, I'd plant crookneck, I would plant any of a number of other varieties, and I think you'll find them more satisfactory. But if you just want a spurt of zucchini and then a little hiatus from zucchini and then a late season abundance of zucchini, that's the way
And
to
I would always recommend that people not plant the green one, but plant the yellow one.
go.
And the reason for that is you can find it on the bush before it gets the size of a watermelon.
Yes, you can catch them early and pick them when they're still at a nice tender stage. There's one summer squash that I highly recommend if you can find it. And if you can't find the plant, you can always get the seed and start it yourself because there's plenty of time still to plant these from seed. Tromboncini. Tromboncini, which kind of looks like a trombone. It's an extremely long, so this is really cool to grow if you have kids. They get like 3 feet long. And they kind of curve, especially if you're on the ground, they may curve in great ways. If they're hanging, they might be a little bit straighter. And most of it is the skinny, like let's say 3 inch diameter portion, which is firm textured. And then way down at the end is the bulbous part, which is a little softer textured. One of the objections a lot of people have to squash is that when you cook it, it's squashy. It's gross. Many young people don't like the texture. They'll probably like patty pan, they'll probably like tromboncini better because they're firmer textured, less seed cavity, more firm, fleshy part. Tromboncini, very distinctive, slightly nutty flavor, definitely worth looking for. As to the other, all the different types of zucchini, I'll never forget a conversation we had in the 1980s with a gentleman who came into the nursery. He said to us when we were talking about zucchini, he goes, "I'm a zucchini breeder.
Oh
They
my.
all taste the same." Okay. The only differences, breeding for commercial agribusiness, but also home garden, the only differences are really with respect to color, texture, and thickness of the skin. So if you're a farmer, you want a zucchini that holds up a little better in shipping. That's going to be really important. You don't want winter squash level of skin. You don't want something that is going to be that hard, but you want something that doesn't bruise when you just like hit it a little bit. You don't want something that's easily damaged because any point of injury becomes a point of rot. So you want something with a little bit tougher skin. That was one of the things they were breeding for. The color, bright yellow. Yes, when Gold Rush zucchini came on the market, I immediately started growing that one because it's beautiful, slightly softer textured, but you could, as Lois said, you could pick it early. You could pick them when they're only 3 or 4 inches long because you could see them in there. So that was desirable. As far as he was concerned, the flavor is all pretty much the same, but there are slight flavor differences between zucchini and other summer squash. And I think if you're looking for something with a good, interesting flavor, look for tromboncini.
We end our show with a quote from Andrew Weil. A garden with vegetables, fruits, and flowers feeds body and soul.
You've been listening to the Davis Garden Show with Don Shore.
And Lois Richter here at KDRT LP 95.7 in Davis, California.
Please help us keep Kadert's grassroots growing strong.
We're a garden show, so we're real interested in roots, and you can help.
You can donate your cash, your car, or even your time. For more details, head to kdrt.org/support.